My guest at this time is Michael Walsh. He's a former associate editor at Time Magazine and is the author of the brand new book, The People Versus the Democratic Party. Mr. Walsh contends that the Democratic Party is actually a criminal organization, and its tactics, really since its inception, bear that out. And sir, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Greg.
That's usually the type of thing most people probably expect to hear in the heat of a presidential campaign, which we're in right now. But you've gone back and researched the entire history of the Democratic Party, and we'll get into the specific chapters of it here in just a little bit. But what kind of gave you the idea that this has been a theme throughout the history of the organization?
Well, I think really what launched this book was the realization that the left, as it's embodied now by the Democratic Party, is constantly talking about the higher moral ground which they seek to occupy. And in fact, they don't have any higher moral ground. So I go all the way back to Aaron Burr, who was the vice president of Thomas Jefferson and one of the founders of Tammany Hall, and then chart the history of this party from the beginning to now. And it's a pretty sordid and unhappy state of affairs.
Some would say that politics is just a messy business. What distinguishes the Democrats from the rest of those who have played this game in American history?
Well, I think what distinguishes them is a real desire to win. They're the oldest party in the country, obviously. The opposition party has come and gone, whether it's called the Whigs or the Federalists or the Republicans now. But the Democrats have pretty much stayed, and they've stayed because they know how to win, and they're willing to change at the drop of a hat. They're willing to change their policies. You know, they've gone from being the party of slavery and segregation, you know, to now claiming to be the party of the civil rights laws passed in 64 and 65, when in fact those were passed with greater Republican support than Democrat support. But they're always mutating and trying to grab the moral high ground, and it seemed to me they don't really have any moral high ground.
Let's take it back to Aaron Burr for a minute. Obviously, nearly president himself. It was a tiny electoral college. The way that it was resolved in the House of Representatives went to Thomas Jefferson, and Burr was the vice president then. So as he was kind of the initial figure in a party that eventually led to Andrew Jackson being the first member of the Democratic Party to be president of the United States, what were some of the hallmarks of the party right back in that era that gives you pause?
Well, what gives me pause really is the founding of Tammany Hall in New York City. Not only Burr's personal moral character, which is very low. I mean, there's evidence that Alexander Hamilton fired his pistol into the ground, and that Burr then shot him in cold blood during their duel, which was Burr's right, but it shows you what kind of person he was. Then later he got involved in this sort of traitorous land deal. It's all too complicated to go into. But his name lives in infamy for a reason. And one of the reasons it does is that he founded Tammany Hall, which turned into, over the course of its 150-year existence, into the kind of prototypical big-city political machine, corrupt, in league with the most violent gangsters in New York during its heyday, and the source of patronage and power on which the Democratic Party rests.
You talked about how it's evolved over the years to claim the higher moral ground. In the 19th century, how did that manifest itself in addition to the Tammany Hall and the big city machines that were prevalent really up until the middle, or not maybe even further in the 20th century?
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's a good example, Greg. During the Civil War, Lincoln was running for re-election, obviously, in 1864, and the Democrats had a sizable group of Democrats that were called the Copperhead Democrats. And they were running and wrote the platform on a peace-at-any-price policy. They wanted to make peace with the South, get the war over with, split the country, and just write the whole thing off. And they nominated General McClellan, who had been fired by Lincoln for, you know, not being able to win when it counted, as their presidential candidate. Now, Lincoln won that election, but the sort of instinctive anti-Americanism of the Democrats was very clear even in 1864.
Let's move a little bit forward now and go to what is an era a lot of people refer to now. The president repeatedly refers to the current economic crisis as the worst since the Great Depression, and depending on the statistics you look at, it's certainly one of the worst, if not the worst, since then. What were some of the ideas, the themes of the Roosevelt campaign and that era that closely parallel with the Obama era, and what are the major differences, if there are any?
Well, I think what's interesting about the Roosevelt era, if you go back to the 20s and 30s, when you have basically Hoover and Roosevelt. It's also the time of the great gangster empires in America. It's when organized crime was really founded, and that occurred in 1929 in Atlantic City, when every great gangster from all the ethnic groups came to Atlantic City, and they split up the country into zones of influence. But they were very political as well, and the gangsters tended to be Democrats. Except for the Republican mayor of Atlantic City, Nucky Johnson, it's hard to think of a gangster who was not a Democrat. They were very influential in getting Roosevelt nominated in 1932. Al Smith had thought he had their allegiance, but they double-crossed him, and they thought they would get off easy with Roosevelt, who then promptly double-crossed the gangsters and sent Tom Dewey after them in the great cleanup of gangland that occurred in the 30s. But the party's always been in bed with this sort of criminal element, and sometimes a seditious criminal element. And that was also true in the Roosevelt administration, where a number of Roosevelt administration officials turned out subsequently to have been Soviet agents of influence. It's not a pretty sight.
The book is The People versus the Democratic Party. The author is Michael Walsh. And Michael, you hear a lot of folks now, some are who are perhaps even members of what's known as the neoconservative movement, especially as it relates to foreign policy, who say that, well, back in the day, I was a Scoop Jackson Democrat. Or I remember when Harry Truman or John F. Kennedy had a much more America first type of foreign policy, or their approach to tax rates or something like that. So has there been a marked turn in the last couple of generations, or is that just kind of a fond and fuzzy look back?
I think it's a little bit of the latter, actually, Greg. When you think about it, Truman was, when he came up in politics in Kansas City, was the bagman for the great criminal gangster who ran Kansas City, a guy named Tom Pendergast, one of the Irish gangsters. And Truman never lost his affection for Pendergast, even after he was finally, you know, brought to justice and sent to jail. Truman still admired him very much. And, of course, John Kennedy, his father, had been very much in league with various gangsters, including the great Oney Madden, the biggest bootlegger and politically influential gangster in New York City. So, again, there's always this subcurrent running underneath the Democratic presidents. It's true now that there are no Scoop Jackson Democrats, because the party got seized in 1968 in the streets of Chicago during the riots, which I well remember. I was just 18 years old at the time, and is now basically turned into the McGovern-Alinsky group that runs the country today.
Let me get your thoughts on one more thing before we let you go, Michael. This is a quote from your book. With Obama in office, all Washington is a skating rink on which characters like Barney Frank and Chris Dodd turn triple Lutzes, while their media cronies applaud like the Harvard-trained SEALs that many of them are. As we mentioned at the outset, you're a former associate editor of Time magazine, so you've been part of the Fourth Estate. What's your assessment of how they're doing their job right now?
I think it's poor. I was at Time magazine for 16 years, and I loved every minute of it. During the time I was there, I don't ever recall talking about politics in the office. I was the classical music critic. I was away a good deal of the time. But we didn't sit around and talk politics all day long, and that wasn't the entire purpose of the magazine. Now I think that's changed, and the more conservative guys in the mainstream media, like myself, have gravitated elsewhere. I became a novelist and screenwriter, and I do political commentary now mostly on the web. But what's left of the old mainstream media is a pretty hardcore group of leftists whose life's work and ambition is to promote their agenda. And they're doing a good job of it. It's just that they're losing their influence, and I think they'll continue to lose it as the public realizes they're not playing straight with them anymore.
Michael, we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating look at the history of the Democratic Party. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Michael Walsh is a former associate editor at Time magazine. His new book is The People versus the Democratic Party. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.